844-967-2789. 844-96-PARTY.
I cannot not laugh when you do that.
It's easier to remember.
I know, it's just party.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Wisconsin. Hello, Wausau. Hello, Wisconsin Rapids. Hello, Amory. Hello, Richland Center. Hello, Waukesha.
Yes, we are.
Just keeps getting longer, Jane.
All over the place. And I looked up Amory yesterday. Oh. You got it?
I can't hear you.
You can't hear me. So we are having a problem.
Well, it's a good way to start the Friday, though.
The previous show had the same problem.
Well, I'm going to just keep talking.
Okay, I'll be right there.
Jane on the other room.
You wing it for a little
bit. But happy Friday, TGIF. I'm very excited that it's the weekend. I'm very excited for the Packer game on Sunday. And I'm very excited for our guest who is going to help me break down the news of Wisconsin headlines. He is returning champion. And he was here back in July, but I'm so excited for Dr. Phil Rocco, who is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University and author of Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Dr. Phil Rocco, welcome back.
No, it's
I can't hear him.
Can you hear me?
No.
Okay, well...
All right. Well, I'm going to keep talking, even though I can't hear Phil. I can't hear Jane. We are having a great start to this Friday morning. And so I'm not exactly sure what's happening, but we are going to keep talking because this is live radio. And this is what's really fun about doing live radio. And so, Phil, I want to be talking to you right now, but we're going to try to fix this. And so the first topic we were going to talk about, and so I'm just going to start talking about it and see if we can figure out what is happening. The governor's race, as we are 45 days away from the election, I am interested in trying to sift through the headlines and see what's been happening in the governor's race. I know about a week ago, something we never ended up talking about on this show was that the governor of Florida was in Wisconsin, Ron DeSantis. I think he must have stolen my joke because I made a joke before he arrived about the fact that there's so many snowbirds in Wisconsin, and I think he made that joke also on Sunday about being in Naples and meeting a lot of Wisconsin people there. But also, Tim Michaels said something about wanting to halt paroles, which also makes me think that he doesn't fully understand the law because many of those paroles that he referenced were required by law. Governor Tommy Evers wants to try to make a referendum that is actually binding when it comes to abortion. And my big gripe right now is that they're, as of right now, they're only going to debate once, which feels like really giving the short end of the stick to voters to only see a single incumbent governor and a guy who hasn't run since 2004. And the only thing that we really have to know about them is what they say in their political ads and what is going to happen in one debate. And so those were kind of the headlines that we had. Sorry, I have to laugh because I'm looking at Phil on Zoom and I know that he's here and I saw him talking and I want to hear your voice so badly. And but I guess I'm just going to keep talking because I don't know why I can't hear anyone. All right. Well, we are going to... I wish we could go to a break right now, but we can't even go to a break. And so this is hilarious because I wonder if, Phil, maybe you should just call into the line. And so if you call the phone number, 844-967-2789, then I should be able to hear you because I don't think it should not be a Zoom problem, but we're going to try to do that instead. But this is a fun first 8 minutes that, and so the you know, we most of this week, Jane, we got through without technical issues. And this feels like a big one when I can't hear you. I can't hear the guest. And I guess I could just Rush Limbaugh this thing and talk for 3 hours. But that seems like an exhausting way to spend my Friday. And so do we have Phil on the phone? We have Phil on the phone. Phil, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. You can't see me anymore, but I've got a face for radio anyway. So,
well, you look so professorial in your sweater. You look like a fall professor.
I did the whole autumnal guy thing today, and you know, just for this, because I knew you had the live stream going, but. You know, this is fine. This is all good.
This is live radio. You know, sometimes things happen and we just improv. This is why it's so good that I have an improv background, that we can just roll with it because the show must go on. All right. So now that I've already done all the different headlines that kind of popped up as a expert in political science and someone who's been in Wisconsin for a while, what are you interpreting as far as what's going on with the governor's race?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the parole thing struck me as like very illustrative of, you know, the way that Michaels is playing this election. So, like, you know, this is one of these policies where, you know, you can make whatever you can. There's no nutritional facts on policy statements you make on the campaign trail, right? It's like, will this policy be even like remotely workable? Is it like remotely legal? And the answer is, I think, as you said, like, not clear that he understands how sort of the law works and what parole is. But it's sort of illustrative about the kind of way that he's playing, you know, the campaign is really like going and doubling down on the, you know, sort of quote unquote tough on crime, you know, label, which we can get into, you know, whether or not that is sort of reflective of reality in any way. I think the best indication that I've seen thus far is Michael's strategy being getting out the base and speaking primarily to the base, not really focusing on independence, and just trying to, you know, find a way through that, the 3-point gap between himself and Evers, which, you know, is an Evers advantage. But I think trying to just like mobilize kind of the most perhaps extreme parts of the base rather than sort of talking to independents, because that's sort of in a way where his strategies lie, his sort of strategic advantages lie. I think if you look at the way that voters look at Evers and Michaels, you know, there's a much larger plurality who believe that, you know, Evers shares their values, much larger plurality of people who actually think that Evers, you know, cares about people like them. And it's reflected in the fact that that's sort of who Evers is appealing to in the way that he's trying to speak to both people in his own party and independents. Michaels doesn't have those bona fides, right? He, you know, in a way, and I'm sort of surprised that there isn't maybe more talk about the fact that he doesn't live here.
I know. I know.
But, you know,
I mean, I see it a fair amount as far as
the thing is. Yeah.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, I mean, I feel like I see it a fair amount as like every time he says something, there's a lot of stuff on Twitter joking about how he actually lives in Connecticut. But I don't know, because we all know Twitter is not the real world, how much that comes through on for most constituents who would be voting if that is top of mind for them, that he doesn't and hasn't lived here in a long time.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's, let me put it this way, you know, maybe there's some more discussion about it that, you know, sort of around bars or, you know, diners or things like that. But I think it's not like the, you know, Dr. Oz, you know,
totally.
Kind of, you know, thing where it's like really focusing on the fact, because it is, you know, entirely, you know, humorous how little he seems to understand about Pennsylvania. And maybe it's the case that Michael, you know, it's a harder sell because he sort of has a larger sort of like Wisconsin like legacy of being here or something like that. But I think the Evers' strategy at this point is kind of emphasizing that on the issues the voters care about, he's sort of in step with them, and whereas Michaels is really trying to, not alienate the party base and, in fact, mobilize them.
And do you feel like he can win that way? Like, by just doubling down on the conservative base, is the demographics in Wisconsin, does it just mean that independents and non-typical voters wouldn't turn out? Or how does that end up looking or working as far as this being the way forward of not trying to gain independent voters?
Yeah, this is the really interesting thing is the advantage in a midterm election like this one, where you don't have a top ticket race, should be I would expect to see him, maybe overperforming Evers a little bit in the current sort of electoral conditions. But I think the fact that you have this huge Supreme Court decision on abortion, which has an effect here because of the 1849 law, and it's something that Republicans have kind of gotten behind. I think it makes I do think it's made, even if people don't say it's like the number one issue, it is the number one issue for a lot of voters, and it, I think is going to contribute to mobilization in a way that it might not have in, if the Supreme Court had, made a less, explosive ruling, if they had sort of done what they had continued to be doing in the prior few years of just sort of like narrowly tailoring their decisions to a particular state or something like that. I think that this, it creates a somewhat different dynamic. I think it's going to be very, very close. The margins in the last midterm were very close. I think things in terms of Democratic mobilization and turnout in Wisconsin have been trending in a Democratic direction, even in like off-cycle elections. It's the real cop-out answer to say it's going to be very close. That's the biggest sort of cop-out answer. But I do think that there's no way of using. It's really, really hard to use like prior elections as a way of like guiding.
Yeah. All right. Well, hold on to that thought. Then we're going to also talk about the Senate race when we get back. But what I'm really excited to talk to you about is Ford Analytics. All right. So stick around. Our guest this hour is Dr. Phil Rocco. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. We're going to see if I can hear Jane.
Anything?
Nope, still can't hear her. Okay, well, we still have Phil Rocco on the line. Dr. Phil Rocco, can you hear me?
Yeah, of
Yay.
Course. Who's sabotaging this show?
I don't know.
Who's trying to prevent you from hearing Jane?
I don't know. It's not April Fool's. And so there's a chance that someone just really wanted to, get back at me for something. Maybe it was Earl. Maybe it was Earl Ingram who was in here who just wanted to sabotage my Friday. But anyways, so while we are on the subject of the big races, in this segment, I wanted to just get your input on any notable developments in the U.S. Senate race between Mandela Barnes and Ron Johnson.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think obviously the development that's gotten the most attention in the last week or so are these sort of highly, I guess I would say, racialized ads that Johnson supporters are running, linking somehow Mandela Barnes to the issue of crime, and I could say like that's about the least surprising thing in the world of political campaigns, like, oh, surprise, the 1988 like Willie Horton strategy is used yet again by Republicans in an election with a candidate of color on the ballot. But like that's I think that's the bigger sort of development. I think the sort of the thing that has gotten people who are like watching this campaign closely interested is that this huge funding gap that's opened up, Republicans outspending Democrats by more than a $1.6 million over the last 2 weeks. And I think that that's, you know, sort of maybe a result of some reshuffling of funds. I think a lot of Republican candidates kind of at the Senate level are maybe not turning out to be the sure bets that, maybe they were thought to be, you know, prior to the primaries. And so I think there's like, okay, this seems like a better bet. So there's, you know, some money shuffling around there kind of from national PACs. So, you know, you're seeing a lot of Johnson ads on TV. But I think at the same time, there's also like a quiet sort of level of mobilization among groups that are, you know, I think there's an article recently in Reuters about, you know, people who are abortion rights activists sort of mobilizing votes in Green Bay and even in northern Wisconsin. So, you know, I think it's, you know, it's hard to you know, base one sort of projections based on like developments that happen sort of week to week and which are really driven by more momentary changes in sort of the way that the campaigns are playing out.
And I agree with you. And but it's also interesting because I feel like as we've seen multiple polls that have now come out, and obviously we talked about this, I know I talked about this last week, is that a poll is not a predictor. It's not a crystal ball. It is a snapshot in time. And multiple polls now have shown Ron Johnson with a couple points lead. So it does feel like some of the ads, the funding is starting to that's starting to be represented in the polls. And so what do you feel like Mandela's campaign should be doing or focusing on in these 45 days? Because I will admit, like, I don't feel like I see a ton from Mandela right now.
Yeah, and I am not one. I can't even give like anecdata on this because I don't like watch television, so I'm not like constantly consuming that. Like if I see it, I see it at a bar, right, or a restaurant where there's like a TV. But I think that like the big, like a lot of the most important work is kind of the retail politics of canvassing and, you know, making contact with voters. And I mean, that's ultimately the kind of work that ads, you know, it's hard to say like just how effective they are, but I think there's pretty strong evidence on the effectiveness of like canvassing and kind of working with groups that are doing that kind of on a day-to-day basis. And that might ultimately change things, right? Polls are also sort of reflective of, you know, an electorate that's likely voters, and yeah, that's sort of their polls are designed to be a little bit more cautious about who the electorate on election day is. There's literally no method that can tell you that can give you a survey of the people who will guaranteed vote on election day. What they do is they try to you know, give the best picture they can of that by sampling only people who are likely voters, but you know, one of the most important things the campaign could do is actually turn people out. And so that's sort of where I think the Barnes campaign has some work to do. And I think, you know, the campaign and groups that support Barnes, they have some potential here because, you know, Johnson in the last few weeks has sort of made clear, like, he opposes, you know, federal protections for gay marriage. He, you know, obviously supports, you know, a ban on abortion. Like there are a bunch of things that should make it easier to mobilize Democratic voters, and Barnes base. A lot of it might be things that you don't necessarily see on television. A lot of it might be kind of on the ground.
Got it. All right. Well, we're going to move on from the races because there was a report that came out this week that I find fascinating because since I've moved back, I've been really interested in population and how we get people to move back or stay in Wisconsin, similar to how I moved back to Wisconsin and similar to how you moved to Wisconsin. And so we're going to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. But when we come back, we're going to talk about Forward Analytics and their report that they came out this week. And Dr. Phil Rocco will still be here as our guest for the full hour. So stay tuned. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Is it up all night to get data?
Yes, up all night to get data from the neurotransmissions.
Phil, is that your kind of song?
No, absolutely not.
Our guest this hour is Dr. Phil Rocco, who is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. And we are talking about news that happened in Wisconsin this week, and one of, I think, something that caught both of our eyes because we are nerds a little bit. I will say that for myself. I don't know if you would also identify as that, but I actually saw this because you retweeted it. But since moving back to Wisconsin, after being definitely someone who thought I was never moving back to Wisconsin up until literally I got back, the idea of how we get people to move to Wisconsin and stay in Wisconsin has been really interesting to me, because if that is the bigger goal, I feel like that is what both a nonpartisan, bipartisan goal that we get, like anyone can get behind, and then what you debate becomes how do you do that. And so this week, Forward Analytics, which is a nonpartisan Wisconsin-based research organization, released a report that found, based on current migration trends, Wisconsin's 25 to 64-year-old population will decline by 130,000 people by 2030. And, you know, some people might not think that's sexy to talk about this, but it's a big deal because we're already feeling such a labor shortage in this state. And you tweeted the quote, "Wisconsin model isn't a recipe for economic growth. It's a recipe for disempowering the working class and the out party, whose result is population decline." So what did you mean by the Wisconsin model?
Yeah, so I mean, I kept thinking about this this study by Forward Analytics, which, by the way, is totally worth reading. It's very easy to read. It's well written. I know this is not a thing, you know, not a thing maybe you want to tell your friends that you read because it might seem nerdy, but it's really, it's awesome. Everybody should go read it. I mean, basically, they found that net migration into Wisconsin was down nearly a third compared to 2010. So the net inflow outflow, like on net, are people moving into Wisconsin once you account for people moving in and out. Net migration in Wisconsin is down a third, and then it's down 75% from the 1990s, which is, you know, that's astonishing. And if you think about, like, why does this matter? It is the people who move into the state that create its economy. That's how we get, you know, booming, bustling places. That is how we get the communities that people want to live in. It's how we get the revenue, too, to support public work. So, like, you know, you want a state that is attractive for people to move to. And I think this is sort of astonishing, too, because it's not like Wisconsin doesn't have a lot of great things to offer, right? Like, I love this place. It's
totally
beautiful. You've got great, great summers. You've got a lot of amazing nature. You just went to, like, Washington Island this summer, and it's just, like, one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to. And there are great schools, you know, the UW system, Marquette. There's a lot to like here. Actually, like K-12 performance is pretty high on a statewide basis compared to other states around the country. So, like, what's going on here? And it struck me that one thing that sort of changed in the 2010s is that we got a really different mix of policies in this state as pertains to people's working conditions and their wages, right? Mm-hmm. And when I say the Wisconsin model, I mean this idea that, you know, under Scott Walker, the sort of policy was we are going to try to attract businesses here by lowering workers' power, like, you know, weakening workers' power by, you know, reducing the number of people who were in a union, and giving, you know, huge tax incentives, places like Foxconn, and at the same time rejecting, you know, millions and millions of dollars in federal aid for Medicaid and transportation. You know, there's a great podcast, Derailed, about why Wisconsin rejected a huge federal funding package for high-speed rail, which is, everybody should go listen to. And if you look at other states, they didn't do that. And so there's some really great work in comparing kind of like how did Minnesota, a state with similar, let's just say, climatological challenges, like people don't like the winters, and so you get a lot of snowbirds and things like that. So, like, you know, look at another upper Midwestern state, and, you know, job growth since 2010, markedly stronger in Minnesota. Minnesota experienced like 11% growth in total non-farm employment between 2010 and 2018. Wisconsin growth was, you know, significantly lower than that. I think only about 7.9%. Wages grew faster in Minnesota and Wisconsin over the last decade. Gender wage gaps shrank more in Minnesota than they did in Wisconsin. Median household income in Minnesota also grew much faster than it did in Wisconsin as well. And Minnesota made much better progress in reducing overall poverty, including especially child poverty, than Wisconsin did. So, you know, we undertook a bunch of policies here, including, I should also say, rejecting expanded federal unemployment insurance in the 2010s that I think, especially for younger people who, you know, are, you know, looking for jobs in larger, more booming cities, have sort of acted as a detractor when it comes to staying in Wisconsin, especially in the you know, early 20s to early 30s. And that's actually, you know, one of the biggest, I think, challenges kind of going forward, is that we have this sort of policy mix, and with the state legislature sort of composed as it is, it's hard for, you know, a different governor to adopt a different economic model than the one that's sort of locked in.
We're talking to Dr. Phil Rocco, who is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University, and we're talking about a new report that came out this week from Forward Analytics about our declining working age population. And I think that is interesting, because I did a very unscientific poll on Twitter asking people for their suggestions of what would get people to move here. And it's, granted, you can imagine the type of people who follow As Goes Wisconsin. They're definitely more left-leaning. And so I didn't hear a lot of ideas from conservatives. But the one that I do hear a lot is eliminate income tax. And I think that's interesting, one, because where we're losing a lot of people to is Illinois and Minnesota. And so,
yeah,
even though I know that Rebecca,
more progressive income tax.
Yeah, and like, it was funny because I remember making fun of Rebecca Clayfish during the Republican primary debate, because she listed that's why kids, like, after they graduate college, that's what, how they choose where they want to move to, is because of income taxes. I was like, no, they don't. And it is like, that's not what you're thinking about. You're thinking about, what fun city can I live in? What has a good job opportunity? And I think that's another thing, as far as I compared this to, I mean, because we're not the only state that's having this issue. This is a countrywide issue. And so there was, the census had done a flash chart on dependency rate, which is basically the rate of working age people compared to how many people are retiring. And there was a map of the whole country compared to 2010 to 2019. And it's color coded. And the green color was which part of the states of the whole country had a fairly healthy dependency rate, and that was green. And by the time the difference between 2010 and 2019 is there everywhere, there's a whole lot less green. And where you can see that there is still green is cities, is metropolitan areas. And so I think that is an indicator that we should invest in cities. And so when we talk about what we're going to talk about in that last segment, which is divesting in Milwaukee as a strategy, is not going to help Wisconsin economically as far as where you can attract people that they, where young people want to live, which is where there's things happening, both job wise, but also culturally.
Yeah, exactly. And if you think about, like, how does that happen? Right? Where does that desirability come from? Right? And it comes from having, on the one hand, a kind of thriving labor market in fields that younger people are in, such that, you know, one of the things that people are looking for is, okay, are there job opportunities in the field that I'm interested in? But also, if I decide that, you know, I don't want to necessarily do that, or I, you know, start working a job and I don't like it, I want to leave, or I get fired, or something, you know, something untoward happens, am I going to is there going to be opportunity elsewhere? Or, you know, is the sort of consolation of living in that place, you know, does that provide some other sort of, buttress to, like, you know, keep me there? And the reality is, if you, you know, have policies that don't, you know, induce the production of you know, decent wage jobs, and don't attract firms with, job opportunities for a younger labor market, or if you spend, a prodigious, historical amount of money on attracting a firm that does not, in fact, produce any jobs, but instead has a completely, like, empty factory, or largely empty factory compared to what it was, promised to do, you're not going to attract those things. And that's actually, it's those sort of resources too that then give you the ability to do cultural production, which is, another sort of thing in the way that the city's desirability is sort of manufactured. Because ultimately, when you live in a city, you don't just go to the places where, tourists come, right? You live in a neighborhood. And so, there have to be things there for that, in a way people want to do. And I think the imprint that was sort of like left on Wisconsin is like, well, this is a state where it's really hard to join a union. Younger people want, a way of having their working conditions, their wages protected through collective bargaining. That's one thing that we know increasingly. And at the same time, the state is also adopting a mix of policies where it's like, oh yeah, we're not going to do Medicaid expansion. So, if you get sick here, I guess good luck paying the, premiums on the exchanges, right? That's the sort of, and if you don't have health insurance through your job, like, good luck with that. And now with, I think the abortion fight also sort of crystallizes it, which is that, like, there is a real question about, what kinds of, with respect to individual rights and liberties, are going to be respected in Wisconsin. And I think that's why I sort of said, like, it's worth looking at this not just through an economic lens, right? Why would you put a model like this into place if you were concerned about growing the economy of the state? I think, like, one hypothesis, and one would have to, collect some data, more comparative data on this to illustrate it, is that this is not about economics. It's not about attracting people or businesses to a state. It's about trying to change the political geography of a state in a way that's advantageous to your party by creating a signal that causes people who are disproportionately in the out party, younger people, to move elsewhere and effectively continuing a trend of, like, depopulating urban areas, which then further tilts the political geography in your favor. Right now, I don't, am I saying that that's what they deliberately planned to do? No. I mean, obviously, you need more evidence to illustrate that, but I think it's, like, it's hard for me to reconcile the idea of, like, the policies that Wisconsin undertook over the last 10 years with an economic, political economic model of regional growth. It just doesn't.
It doesn't gel. Make sense. It like, and that's, I mean, and we're going to talk about specifically when we come back from the next break is as far as what is the reason why the state legislature won't invest in Milwaukee. And so I want to keep this, it's tied in as far as what is the political reason, which you kind of just illustrated, but also how does this have any long-term foresight as far as being good for the state? So we will talk about that and the Milwaukee budget proposal that was proposed this week. Our guest this hour is Dr. Phil Rocco, who is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Stick around. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Friends, that it's fun. We're up on that to get data. 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 We're up on that to get data.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Our guest this hour is Dr. Phil Rocco. So we were talking before the break about population and young people and getting them to stay in Wisconsin and economic policy. And one of the things that you suggested is whether, not accusation as far as this being on purpose, but, well, it kind of makes sense when you think about, is it being done on purpose as far as disinvesting in our cities on the choice of the state legislature, which has been held by Republicans for the last 10 years, will likely be held by the Republicans for the next 10 years. And we're in this situation where Milwaukee, which is the economic heart of the state, is not getting much help and hasn't been getting much help from the state for a very long time. And we're seeing that come to a head right now as Mayor Chevy Johnson proposed his put his budget proposal out this week, of which, reluctantly, there was some cuts. I think it was 17 police officers. And not shockingly, he immediately had different partisan hacks criticizing his budget. And what I appreciated was Mayor Johnson got a little saucy on Twitter and stood up for the city. And he said, you know, he said to Tony, who's running, the Republican candidate for Attorney General, who, you know, had to sit, put his piece out there, but he just fired Chevy Johnson and fired back, said, Milwaukee's not your punching bag. And I think a lot of us in Milwaukee went, yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and it's funny because the context of that debate is so sort of laughable. The, you know, Tony sort of suggesting that, like, the mayor is like defunding the police, and you can't see it, Kristen. I in the Journal Sentinel this morning, they published the City of Milwaukee budget summary on, I forget what page it was. I pulled it out. Looking at the police department, looks like a pretty significant increase, 7.3% in the funding, and, by the way, still largest line item in the city's general fund budget. So, like, you know, it's obvious, like, that's just a, you can say whatever you want now, I guess. But it's fun to me just how easy it is to debunk.
Oh, it's totally, I mean, and that's the thing, and that's what Mayor Johnson said right back. He goes, we're increasing funding, but it's just 17 less officers. And, it, you know, so much of this comes back to just playing on people's fears about crime and big bad Milwaukee, but it just, it goes back to what we were talking about in the previous segment, that I don't understand the foresight in this as far as what happens if our biggest city continues to crumble, where so many people who may not live in Milwaukee but work in Milwaukee and depend on Milwaukee, like, what is there to gain by not investing in our biggest city?
I mean, this is where I think the challenge confronts us, in part because we are looking for a set of relationships in the world based on the presumption that we like live in a stable democratic, you know, society where you would expect that like in a state there would be some functional interest, like, I don't know, attracting more investment and employment and growing, you know, growing the economy. But we don't live in that world, I don't think, in Wisconsin. I don't think that we live in like a stable, you know, well-functioning democratic society. I think we live in an increasingly autocratic subnational regime, like autocratic subnational regimes elsewhere. And one reason why is that, you know, rather than, you know, doing what the state had done for, you know, close to a century of sharing back revenues with local governments, in a way, in part because it is the local governments that provide a lot of the key services in the state, and, you know, including the things that make it attractive to migrate to Wisconsin or migrate your business to Wisconsin. The state legislature has sort of hoarded revenues and as a way of centralizing power. And, you know, one way it's done that quite covertly is just by not adjusting our state shared revenue payment formula for inflation. So, yeah. You know, the state shared revenue payment that Milwaukee gets is about $230 million. That number hasn't changed since 1995. So if you were to adjust it for inflation, there'd be like $150 million additional dollars that we would be able to use to plug, you know, what is potentially going to be a really dramatic fiscal gap in the years to come, and a gap that could really be, you know, deeply problematic for the city. And I think the important thing to take away from this is that this is not a like the revenues that a city gets and the way that it does its fiscal policy, the way that it decides how to tax and spend, is not just like the product of like natural forces in the world, like, you know, property values rising and falling and income just sort of, you know, sporadically rising and falling and things like that. It's the product of politics. This is a political project of disempowering large cities because they are a threat to the party that currently controls the legislature and relies primarily on, you know, rural jurisdictions to hold on to its grip on power. And cities have long been a problem for incumbent elites. You know, in the early 20th century, you saw a very similar thing where after the 1920 census, which revealed for the first time that it was a majority urban country, you saw pressure from rural members of Congress to just not redistrict for an entire decade. They just canceled democracy for a decade. In the 20s, didn't redistrict, and state legislatures didn't do it either until they were required to by the Supreme Court in the mid-1960s. And that is the product of an urban-rural split that in which you have concentrated interests who are threatened by large urban metropolitan areas politically. They're a threat to their power. And so they do whatever they can, and in this case, they can't just refuse to redistrict. So what do? They gerrymander, and they try to make it very difficult for cities to, you know, produce an effective mix of services for people, including things like, you know, parks and recreation. Right? They try to make cities permanently failing. So right now, you know, the Milwaukee currently functions primarily not as, you know, like an economic growth, potential economic growth engine for Republicans in the state legislature. It functions primarily as like a symbol. You know, it's like whatever, you know, sort of narrative about like disorder, American carnage or whatever, like Milwaukee is, you know, they can just be a symbol for all of it, like a reservoir of all of those things. And it's helpful if you don't ever come here.
Yeah.
Right. As well. Easy to have it as a symbol if you don't ever come here.
All right. Well, on that note, this hour flew by, even though we weren't on Zoom, but we were going to have you back, maybe in studio, but at least on Zoom. Dr. Phil Rocco, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your insight on everything going on in Wisconsin. And yet we choose to live here. And so we'll see you next time. Thanks so much. Stay with us through the break. This is As Good.